Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to warmly welcome the people in the room and the people online who are joining us from different parts of the world and different parts of their houses. But you're with us and we're very much welcoming you. We are having today a celebration and a reflection around the wonderful book that our colleague, Professor Tammy Rantanen, has recently published. You can see the brilliant title on the screen, Dead Man's Propaganda, Ideology and Utopia in Comparative Communications. I'm here to chair the event. My name is Miria Georgiou, and I am joined, apart from our wonderful main speaker, Tammy Rantanen, by a group of great colleagues in the room and online. Let me first say a couple of things on the panel, and then I will briefly introduce our panelists. This panel will focus on the history, trajectories, and blind spots of comparative communications research. And the point of departure of tonight's conversation is Professor Tammy Rantanen's new book. In the book, Dead Man's Propaganda, Ideology and Utopia in Comparative Communication Studies, Professor Rantanen discusses how concepts of ideology and utopia and the power play between them have influenced comparative communication research and effectively its biases, as well as the boundary setting work that it does, defining insiders and outsiders. Through a thorough investigation, which included archival research and case studies, Professor Rantanen invites us to understand and challenge dominant orthodoxies in the intellectual histories of communication studies. We will start this conversation with Professor Rantanen's own presentation of the book's key ideas. We will then invite our panelists to respond to the key themes addressed in the book from their own position and expertise. Following their initial reflections, we will have a round of exchange between the panelists before we open the floor to the audience in the room and online. My colleague, Luam Tesfaye, who is somewhere in the room, is collecting questions from the online audience, and she will share them with us in due time. So let me now briefly introduce our esteemed speakers. First of all, of course, Tammy Rantanen, who's a professor in global media and communications in the Department of Media and Communications here at the LSE. She's the founder of the department's two double MSc programs, first with the University of Southern California, USC, which she directed from 2000 to 2024, and then with Fudan University in Shanghai, which she directed for the first 3 years. Our panelists, who I will introduce in alphabetical order and who will speak in alphabetical orders, are the four esteemed colleagues I will briefly introduce to you. Bingjun Meng is a professor in the Department of Media and Communications at the LSE, where she also co-directs the LSE Fudan Global Public Policy Research Center. Professor Meng is currently the director of the LSE PhD Academy and the Economic and Social Research Council Doctoral Training Partnership. Jeff Pooley, who is joining us remotely, he's somewhere there behind the screen, is a lecturer at the Annenberg School of Communication, and he's an affiliated professor of media and communication at Malmberg College. He also directs mediastudies.press, a non-profit open access publisher in communications and media studies. His teaching and research interest center on the history of communication research, social media and identity, and scholarly communication. Marsha Schiffert, who's also joining us remotely, specializes in cultural and communication history, particularly media industries and public diplomacy, from the 19th century to the present. The most recent of her 6 edited books is titled Labor in State Socialist Europe, 1945-1989, Contributions to the History of Work. Since 2020, she has taught in the Central European University Erasmus Master's Program titled History in the Public Sphere. Last but not least, our colleague Wendy Willems is associate professor in the Department of Media and Communications at the LSE. Her research engages with the politics of global academic knowledge production and ongoing debates in the internationalization, de-westernization, and decolonization, all in quotations, of the field of media and communication studies. As part of a recent Leverhulme Research Fellowship, Dr. Willems is currently finalizing a monograph titled Postcolonial Publics and Digital Culture, drawing on her long-term research on digital technology in Southern Africa. With no further ado, I want to invite Professor Rantanen to introduce the event.
It is a pleasure to see you all in this event organized by the Department of Media and Communications. I have been a very proud member of the department for 25 years. I actually joined it before it existed in 2000. One of the many reasons I wrote my book was that we all do comparative research in our department, and the department has always emphasized how important it is to do comparative communications. We all come from different countries, and so do our students. I can't hold it at the same time when I'm... So can I use this one?
Okay.
Let's try again.
We all do comparative research on media and communication, at least in two locations, if no more. And we also run our double degrees, as Miria said, in global media and communications, where students spend the first year here in London and then their second year in Cape Town, Los Angeles, or Shanghai. We are, in fact, a department of comparative communication and media, because we all do comparative research in one way or another. Miria, I'm not trying to change the name of the department, but I just wanted to make this point. So, my question today is, what are and what were the criteria when we do comparative communications research? How do we make sure that it remains independent when so much of it is often done as policy science? The term first was used by Harold Laswell, one of the characters in my book, who defined it as when researchers are providing policymakers with pragmatic problem-solving recommendations. So, in this presentation, I will talk about the keywords in my title to make 5 points, but not in the same order as in the title. First, I will talk about debt. Second, about men. Third, about the concepts of ideology and utopia, insiders, outsiders, and generations. Fourth, about propaganda research. And fifth, and finally, about comparative communications research. So let's start with the dead. The idea behind dead men's propaganda is that the dead keep their secrets. And this is why it is so important to do historical research. On the origins of comparative communication research, we know so little about. However, I did not want to write a history of a discipline or a field of media and communication studies that has been competently done by others, including one of our panelists. Instead, I wanted to explore what potentially happens before research is disciplined in the writing of history or media and communication studies. Even when I only concentrated on the United States, often described as the birthplace of communication studies, I emphasized the value of the work by those who were not canonized as the founding fathers of US communication studies. They include Nathan Leitis, an emigre scholar from Russia and Germany, and Paul Keskemeti, another emigre scholar from Hungary and France, both forgotten by future generations. By concentrating on the period before the field of communication studies was institutionalized, I was able to see the influence of European thinkers and argue that what became domesticated as US communication studies is also part of our history of media and communication studies through comparative communications research. In this way, my argument is that communication studies should always be understood as inherently transnational or global or cosmopolitan, you choose, through its theorization, methodologies, research, or objects of study. If this is forgotten, and it often is, historical research will reveal periods when it happened and when it was hidden. Second, let's talk about men. I did not intend to write a book almost exclusively about men, but the further I progressed in my research, the clearer it became that women were largely absent from comparative research of the period I was writing about. Dead men's propaganda also signals the obvious but seldom acknowledged gender obliviousness of histories of intellectual achievements and the gender bias that largely excluded women from academia. Comparative communications and international communication that became a subfield of media and communication studies has always been male-dominated, as all the members of the panel well know. Our own department may be an exception to the rule, as the presence of my colleagues on the panel testifies. But we are not part of the international communication canon. Have we been able to break the invisible glass ceiling there? My argument is, unfortunately, not. And that we are still influenced by the ideology that excluded women from research. We still carry on our shoulders the founding fathers' male tradition that started in the United States after the First World War. Another issue, and I'm sure my colleagues on the panel will talk about it, is the influence of US comparative communication studies worldwide, and how it has concentrated often only on Western countries. Third, why did I use the concept of ideology and utopia? The concept of ideology has been very popular in British cultural and media studies through the work of Stuart Hall and others for several decades. However, almost 100 years ago, in 1929, Karl Mannheim, an emigre scholar from Hungary and Germany at LSE, not only emphasized the importance of the concept of ideology, but paired it with the concept of utopia. Even if these two concepts are sometimes fuzzy and overlapping, they are helpful, especially when we try to understand how individuals survive under strong ideologies. When ideologies have often been understood as permanent and impenetrable, for example, capitalism, utopias, for example, socialism, have been understood to promote social change. However, one has to be cautious not to romanticize the concept of utopia. It is tempting to think that one of the two concepts of ideology and utopia might be somehow less distorted. But in fact, it is important to remember that both are distorted. When studying individuals, as I did in my book, to see them only as carriers of dominant ideologies makes a very short and uninteresting study, in my view. But seeing them and their lives as a battlefield of both ideologies and utopias makes the task much more complicated, but ultimately more rewarding. By adding Robert Merton's concept of insiders and outsiders, further emphasizes that individuals as members of generations, yet another concept from Mannheim, face internal and external competition and are far from homogeneous even if they share the same ideologies. Merton's insider-outsider concepts are also helpful because they further emphasize the power play inside and between generations, sharing or not sharing the same ideologies and utopias. So, what's my argument here? My argument here is that it is difficult, if not impossible, to recognize how contemporary research is influenced by different ideologies and utopias. But by doing theory and history of knowledge production, or sociology of knowledge, as Mannheim called it, we become more aware how previous generations have influenced our thinking. The theory and history of knowledge production must include critical historical analysis in order to avoid the very fallacies of the period under study, if it concentrates only on the insiders of a particular period. It often thereby misses the critical voices of that same period and is thus unable to renew itself. Fourth, why is previous research on propaganda important today? It started after the First World War and formed the foundations of comparative communications research as war propaganda studies. We are now living in dangerous times and witnessing new global cold and hot wars after a relatively long period of, if not peace, at least controlled military aggression. Everybody does propaganda in a military conflict situation. Not only the enemy, but us as well. This is why Laswell and his colleagues studied propaganda in different countries, including the United States. Understanding how war propaganda research, latterly almost forgotten, was done before, between and after the two world wars. In the US, by emigre scholars and policy scientists, has much to teach us. Laswell and his colleagues always emphasized that propaganda is everywhere. In his view, even advertising was a form of propaganda. For Laswell, propaganda was neither intrinsically good or bad, but an instrument of persuasion that could be used for positive or negative causes. So my argument here is that if we do not only need to familiarize ourselves with previous research, but we need to start doing academic research on propaganda without wearing the ideological lenses our predecessors did. And fifth and finally, I come back to comparative communications research. Propaganda research gave birth to media and communication studies in general and to comparative communications studies in particular. The propaganda research, active during the Second World War, set a precedent for close collaboration between academic and policy science. This close collaboration continues until today. But who sets the terms? Whose ideologies and utopias are we following when doing our comparative communications research? My final argument is that we should take comparative communication research even more seriously than we have so far, and have our own eyes tested to make sure that we wear the best possible lenses to correct our eyesight. I would like to finish by thanking my department and the panelists here and on Zoom, who will not talk about my book, but talk about their own research and how it contributes to today's topic, comparative communication research in a historical or contemporary perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm sure you have your questions that you can keep in your mind until we have the Q&A later on. We'll now move to our panelist. Professor Meng is going to talk from the chair here. If we can have the questions on the slides. Each of our speakers was invited to address one or more of four key questions, which hopefully we can see in a minute. The questions are, how do you see knowledge being produced in comparative media and communications research? Who is remembered as an insider and who is forgotten as an outsider by the generations that follow in comparative media and communications research? Do we often or always or actually rarely see a researcher set aside their own utopias? Finally, how often do you see researchers conforming to hegemonic ideologies and research agendas supported by powerful institutions? And we'll hear different perspectives from our panelists. Professor Meng.
Thank you, Mireille. First of all, I just want to say how happy I am to be on this panel, because I think in the last few years, Thierry and I have had many conversations about the book. And I think in a way, I've also witnessed the joy and also the frustration during the research. And I'm just really happy that now we are here today to celebrate the fruit of Terry's intellectual labor. So we have been given these four questions, and I thought maybe I will address the first one. But hopefully, by way of addressing the first one, I could also make connection with some of the other questions. I actually went back to the lecture slides for our double degree students. It's a core course that Terry and I used to co-teach, and we used to have one lecture on doing comparative research. So I want to start by quoting from something that we had on those lecture slides, which is a quote by the post-colonial scholar Gayatri Spivak, who said, comparison is never a question of compare and contrast, but rather a matter of judging and choosing. Now, of course, if we are talking about judging and choosing, we are talking about a series of decisions one needs to make before one can judge and choose. And I think there are also many different ways of unpacking this statement from Spivak. And I think today, in the spirit of Tehi's book, I think instead of talking about or try to unpack this sentence from a more abstract or theoretical perspective, I want to start by talking about comparative communication research and the biography of researchers. So that's the first point I want to make. That is how much our own research agenda often is associated with our identity, with our own with our biography. And if I reflect on my own journey and my own research trajectory, I can't speak for all migrant academics, but I think for me, there's always this anxiety, this simultaneous anxiety about both fitting in and also having a voice. And I think in a way, it's this kind of anxiety that gives me maybe the incentive and push me to always think comparatively, to do comparative research. Because I think it, in a way, it's also interesting that all of us on the stage, we are teaching and writing and researching in a language that's our second language. So I think for me, there has always been this reflection. And in a way, when you need to write a statement about your research trajectory, this anxiety about whether, you know, I am able to join the bigger conversation around me. But then, in order to make the effort to join the conversation, there's also the simultaneous anxiety about, so what's my contribution? Am I going to have a distinctive voice of my own? So I think for me, this is where I see the connection between the biography of a researcher and the research agenda they pursue. And I think in a sense, when Terry said our department in a way centers around this agenda of comparative research, I guess it also has a lot to do with the composition of the department. But I think, of course, with this anxiety, in a way, it also comes there's also advantage to that. And I think also to refer to maybe the founding father of the department, to speaking of men again, that the advantage that's associated with proper distance, that is when we are migrant academics, when we keep distance from where we come from, sometimes we gain new vantage points, we gain new insights. So that's the first point I want to make. And secondly, I think looking at all of you here and thinking about the many conversations that Terry and I have had over the years, not only about our research, but also about how the research inform our teaching. And I think it's also true for many of these academics that you wrote about in your book, that they took their identity as the teacher very seriously, at least as seriously as a researcher, if not more so. I think Mannheim and Merton, and they are all. And I think to pursue comparative research as a teacher is also a way of better engage with our students, especially given the diversity of the student body at LSE. So looking around the room and in a place like LSE, where a simple question like "Where do you come from?" can actually trigger maybe a whole essay. And I think, I guess, the question for us as teachers in this institution really is not why you pursue comparative research, but really is how can you not pursue comparative research, or how can you not think comparatively? So I think this, for me, if I reflect on my own experience, are maybe the sort of the two drives that push me to pursue the kind of research agenda I pursue. But then also, as Tahi also mentioned, that as academics, we don't do research in a vacuum. There are also other, in a way, maybe you can also call them countervailing forces that are also playing a role in shaping and configuring. And sometimes we have to, in our research agenda, and sometimes we do have to negotiate or struggle with that. So first of all, I think academics as researchers, we are constantly disciplined by our disciplinary norms and also disciplinary boundaries. I still remember when Tahi and I co-authored our first article about the changing of lens and thinking about trying to make a case about a new agenda for comparative research. The critical comments, the doubtful questions raised to us, and also the rejections that we experienced, I think in a way is testament to that kind of very powerful sort of the discipline of the disciplinary norms. And similarly, I think in terms of disciplinary boundaries, we also had a lot of conversation about, so where do you see your research fit in the disciplinary sense, the approach and methods we take. So I only have 2 minutes left. My last point is about how, if we think about people like Mannheim and Laswell, of course, they are also the products of their times. And I think in the contemporary moment, our research agenda is also unavoidably shaped by other powerful institutions, both academic and non-academic institutions. And I think in terms of non-academic institutions, that the funding body has a very important role to play in deciding, which kind of research will be foregrounded, will be supported, will be highlighted. And also there is, I think, what I would call maybe both the steering and also the chilling effect of the overall political environment. I think at the moment, if I reflect on my own research as a China scholar and also as a Chinese China scholar, often I have to negotiate with this kind of political imperatives. For example, in the contemporary geopolitical environment, if I take maybe a more hawkish view about China, you can gain more platform and maybe a stronger voice. And then I think overall there is the, I think Tahi already mentioned, the overall containment of the hegemonic ideology. And I know I don't have more time to elaborate on that, but I think there's a lot to be said about ideology and propaganda. And I think in comparative research, often especially in comparative research about media system, there seem to be this view that, you know, those, the media, the system in the liberal democratic system, concepts like ideology and propaganda are irrelevant, and they only become useful or relevant when we are talking about non-liberal media system. But I think that's something that we've been trying to contend. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think even though you said you would address only the first question, I think all the questions are present in your contribution. We're going to go to Jeff Pooley now, who is online. So hopefully, yes, we can have you there. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, I hope you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me. I want to first just thank you for the invitation and also to extend a profound congratulations to Terry for the superb book. And as a point of departure, actually, I want to take jump off of three facets of the book. The first, Terry, you had already mentioned that you focus almost exclusively on pre-disciplinary figures, social scientists, journalists, maybe with the partial exception of Wilbur Schramm. That's the first. The second is that you explicitly address the book to colleagues that are beyond the media communication research discipline. And the final is my favorite, just the book's rich engagement with the sociology of academic knowledge. And I guess I want to pick up in the most cursory way where you had left off, Terry, which was the institutionalization of the field. In the US case, it's more complex than the UK, but in the US case, communication colonized pre-existing journalism schools and speech departments. And the relevant consequence was that the discipline was a sort of at the low status professional school margins of the university, where it remains. And so it had lots of students, but no respect. And I think in sociology of knowledge terms, this had intellectual consequences that were bad ones loosely. I'm quoting from memory here, but Jeremy Tunstall in this great 1983 essay on the trouble with US communication research said, you know, the fact that a single human being can teach methods of social psychology and magazine editing is a testament to human adaptability, not to a well-conceived academic discipline. And the main point there is this kind of vocational taint penalty that the discipline had, even as it sucked the oxygen of faculty lines from other disciplines that had been studying media. And communication was as a result of kind of insecure science, to use Ian Hacking's term. And this had an effect in the balance of intellectual trade. That is, ideas could come into the field, but they could never leave. I think of this as like the Hotel California. And communication scholars, including in the comparative fields, have been not read or cited all that much. And I want to register a change that might be, in ironic, hopeful terms, a gain of some kind since the mid-1990s. Of course, communication in the US and around the world has always been baggy and undisciplined. In the sociologist of science, Richard Whitley's terms, it is a fragmented adhocracy. But I do think there's been a change since the mid-1990s and the popularization of the World Wide Web. Maybe I'll distinguish between communication as it would be from the post-war to about that period. Yes, it was heterogeneous, fragmented, but that heterogeneity was inside the tent. It was internal to the field. I would call that type 1 heterogeneity. And I'd say since the mid-1990s and the advent of and popularization of the World Wide Web, we have type 2 heterogeneity that's external to the organized discipline. Yes, we still have the internal messiness, but the new prominence of the web began drawing scholars from other disciplines. And this time, they weren't all absorbed into communication departments. And so as a result, there's like a kind of joint custody, I think. The shared jurisdiction over this post-convergence domain of the digital. And for some disciplines like sociology, this was a revival of the old preoccupation, right? Largely ceded to communication research. And I think, therefore, that this represents, in a way, Terry, a kind of return to your pre-World War II period, in a way. And I think this is mostly a good for the study of comparative media and for the study of media more broadly. One thing, Merton's insider-outsider distinction that you draw upon so brilliantly in the book is less pronounced in a way. I even think that vocational penalty I referred to earlier, that sort of Hotel California effect, is less important, since we're all students of digital society, regardless of anything that happens to appear on the department office door. But I'll leave you, and I really am kind of answering the first two questions, I suppose. One arguably bad effect of this type 2 heterogeneity is the declining significance of disciplinary memory for practicing scholars today. I've done a study of looking closely at the successive issues of the Journal of Communications ferment in the field, which one of the panelists here, Marcia, in its first iteration had an instrumental role to play in. But I looked at the original, 1983, and then the follow-up in 1993, and then 2008, 2018. And one demonstrable finding is that there was just a steady drop in memory claims about the field, And these had just become illegible, is my interpretation. And so one irony is this question that we have up on the screen there, which is, who's remembered today as an insider or forgotten as an outsider? And I would say everyone is forgotten, insiders and outsiders alike. And I'll end on that note, and with again, my gratitude for being invited, and my congratulations again to Terry.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. And we'll move straight to Marcia. Dr. Seifert, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me now.
Yes.
Without an echo. Dear Terry, dear colleagues, thank you so much for the invitation to speak at this event. I was pleased to accept because of the high regard I hold for Terry and her impressive array of publications. I've also benefited enormously from her work in my own work. In my last major editing project in the United States, I published in 1991 a book entitled Mass Culture and Perestroika in the Soviet Union. It appeared on the day that the Soviet Union collapsed, and on that day, I became a historian. Since then, I have read, signed, and admired Terry's work that included the Russian and Soviet perspective, from the telegraph and news agencies to her more recent comparisons of East-East, Russia and China. How fortunate I am, Terry, to have your wonderful article, Howard Interviews Stalin. I come to all of you in the LSE auditorium from the Budapest campus of Central European University, where I'm now in my 30th year of teaching in the history department. In many ways, my university resonates and intersects with your book, Terry. These resonances are not just because I'm in Budapest, from which many of your protagonists originate, but because our university was founded after another war, the first Cold War, in the 1990s, when optimism, read utopia, about the future included bringing students and researchers in from out of the cold. A founding principle was Karl Popper's open society, a critic of your social theorist, Karl Mannheim. At our university, we've housed the archive files of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, another post-war institution in which a form of communications research continued through, quote, men of practice, as you call them. The radio organization, built upon the recognition of the use of emigres for language experience, located in the Munich and later Paris offices. They employed emigre researchers who clipped press reports and prepared situation analyses that were shared with those who prepared the broadcast, as well as their U.S. sponsors. Many of the researchers also went to the RAND Corporation. As is well known, in the 1970s, the radios were revealed to be financed by the CIA, but continued. Whether or not this institution can be seen as a continuation of U.S. wartime research, and also as the location of the so-called anti-communism you describe in the later chapters of your book, it is a topic I hope we can discuss one day in person. My remarks, I also want to address the key word of precariat. This also struck me because I agree with your premise that eventually comparative politics overtook comparative media and communications research. Nonetheless, you are right to emphasize in your first question how and why knowledge is produced through comparison. In your book, you define early comparative communications in the U.S. as a place where researchers are in different locations, different concepts, methodologies, a very, very complete definition. I agree. My time in communication research comes from the subsequent generation, which emerged during the 1960s and 1970s. I was hired, quote, as a woman of practice from Mouton Publishers in The Hague to be associate editor for the Journal of Communication. The editor of that journal, George Gerber, was another Hungarian who left Budapest at the dead of night in 1939. In the beginning of my second year, 1977, we published one of those studies that Terry describes so well, entitled The Many Worlds of the World's Press. George's co-author was another George, Barbandi, from Budapest, a man of practice and collaborator of, the program director for public affairs of the Hungarian television in Budapest. It was an interesting combination, and the study is notable for having looked at newspapers from 10 countries, 60 newspapers, capitalist, socialist, and third world countries. This is a part of the comparison that I would like to emphasize as we talk about comparative, because when do we do comparison across ideologies? What does that mean? How can we actually make something of comparing a newspaper in New York, a newspaper in Budapest, and a newspaper in Moscow? In many ways, this study is also interesting because it was one of the first times I've seen this type of coverage mapped, and in what we would now call visual datafication. In fact, what Terry says at one point in the book is that this was the big data of their time. I think we can go back to it for very good reasons. I will skip so that I'm not too long, but I would just say that in another of these kinds of comparative projects was an issue of the Journal of Communication that I co-edited with Gerber, entitled Ferment in the Field.
Thank you so
Communication
much.
Scholars Address.
And once again, thanks to Terry for inviting me to be on this panel.
This was 1983. What I would stress here is that, again, there was a request from 10 countries. This
degree,
idea of how do we
to teach a course of global media together. And on the way, I've learned a lot about the making of this book as well. So before discussing how our research interests intersect, I do want to mention a few things that struck me about this book, and I think it's important to do that and not to focus only on my own research. So in the book, as Terry has mentioned, she reviews the period between the 20s and the 50s, and she's interested in showing what potentially happens before research is disciplined, and you mentioned this again in your presentation earlier, in the writing of a history of a field. And she uses the term comparative communications to refer to the scholarship that she interrogates. She's interested in a number of dead white men who have been largely forgotten and made important contributions to scholarship in this period. And many of them studied propaganda and were deeply influenced in their work by the two world wars. And what I particularly appreciate about the book is that it is, as Terry writes, an unapologetically old-fashioned and unfashionable book. And during a time where a scholarship is often measured by its impactfulness, we get carried away with fashionable topics in the hope that these might create impact. But I think we lose our creativity and perhaps even our sincerity and sometimes our independence in the process. And clearly this book is a labor of love based on extensive and careful archival research, and I think we need more of these. And as Terry mentions in the book, she's keen to revive a scholarship that's largely forgotten, and she's trying to bring in
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So as my alma mater and LSE, where I would go in the evening after work, as it was one of the few libraries open in the evening at the time. And I too also wondered what to make of all the older books on the shelves that were no longer borrowed by anyone, which were literally gathering dust. And did this huge archive indeed comprise of knowledge that was no longer usable, simply useless? And what I find particularly interesting about Terry's book is that she has decided to draw the main concepts of her book, Ideology and Utopia, and Insider Outsider, from two authors, Mannheim and Merton, who were part of the same generation, roughly part of the same generation as the scholars that she studies. And just like she tells us about the life histories of the key scholars that she focuses on, she also provides brief biographies of Mannheim and Merton. And I'd be curious to if she could elaborate on this decision. And did you feel this contributed to a sense of historical authenticity? Or what were your motivations from drawing your conceptual framework from the same time period? So let me now move to my own research and also to the question that I'm addressing, mostly question 2 and 4. So who is remembered as an insider and who is forgotten as an outsider by the generations that follow? And like Terry, I also have an interest in the history of media and communications as well as in the history of media and communication studies. And like Terry, I'm also interested in both insiders and outsiders. And in an article in Communication Theory, I examined a group of largely forgotten African communication scholars, such as Frank Ubuaja, David Idiani, and Charles Okibo, who in the 80s published important critiques of modernization theory. And in a way, they also responded to some of the scholars that Terry discusses in her book, such as Wilbur Schramm and Daniel Lerner. And while Terry mainly discusses these scholars in relation to the study of propaganda, they became strongly associated with development communication later in their careers. And this again demonstrates how US propaganda studies morphed into development communication in the Cold War context, as Umaro Bah has argued in his book and also in an article in 2008. So African communication scholars challenged modernization theorists on two grounds. First, they argued that the content proposed by modernization scholars was largely irrelevant to the African context. And they also argued that modern mass media were ineffective on the African continent. Instead, they proposed that scholars should take into account indigenous knowledge and forms of communication. And they proposed a number of new concepts, such as the concept of Ora Media, coined by Frank Ubuaja. And as debates on decolonization and the role of media have intensified in recent years, I, like Terry, was keen to point out to the older history of these debates by African scholars in the 80s in journals such as Africa Media Review and platforms such as the African Council on Communication and Education. And furthermore, I was interested to point to the different origins of media and communications scholarship, which is often associated with the US and Europe. But I argue that there are multiple genealogies of the field, which we need to acknowledge more strongly in our historiography. However, my work has not just examined outsiders. I've also researched insiders, but perhaps I've been less kind to these than Terry. In a more recent article in Communication, Culture and Critique, I make an attempt to reread Jürgen Habermas' canonical book, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere in the Context of Slavery and the Slave Trade. And my main motivation for going back to this book was not to situate it so much in its historical period, although I do a little bit of that in the article. Instead, what I wanted to do is to challenge the ongoing relevance of this text, despite all the previous critiques. Whereas previous critiques pointed to absences in relation to gender and class, I was interested in looking at the book in relation to race. And what struck me rereading the book, and particularly the section on the emerging public sphere in 17th and 18th century London, was the complete silence on slavery and the slave trade, even though these crucially shaped this particular time period. So in a sense, I tried to fill in Habermas's gaps and demonstrate a number of links between coffee houses and slavery and the slave trade. So instead of situating older forms of knowledge within their time, I'm increasingly interested in examining knowledge production in relation to harm and in reflecting on what a repertory approach to intellectual history might mean. Following Catherine Hall and David Scott, repertory history involves rethinking the past and how it continues in the present, taking responsibility for the residues of the past and reflecting on what the present owes to the past. Anthropology has already extensively reflected on its harmful past, and I think we have a lot to learn from this in our field too, which again has a controversial history, which Terry alludes to, particularly in relation to the Cold War. And finally, I want to briefly return to the fourth question. How do we see researchers conforming to hegemonic ideologies and research agendas supported by powerful institutions? And I think in every age, we find researchers who conform to hegemonic ideologies and those who resist them. But it's clear that the past year has seen disturbing attempts to curtail academic freedom on campus and where universities have colluded with the state. Just like in 1968, we saw an often violent return of police forces on campuses across the United States and Europe to clamp down on peaceful student and faculty protests. And this is something that should worry all of us. And in addition to threats from the state, we need to look at how the market is changing knowledge production and forcing us to conform to certain types of knowledge production or impacts. We need to examine how the Research Excellence Framework, REF for short, which shapes university funding in this country but also weighs into university rankings, contributes to this process of conformation and the responsibilities we have as powerful institutions to challenge this. So I think this is again why we need more unfashionable books, and I would like to congratulate Terry again on her book, and I hope it will start a new trend.
Thank you. There are many really great ideas put on the table, put forward for our discussion. Before we move to the Q&A, I would like to give the opportunity to the panelists, including our panelists online, to address each other if you have any questions or comments for others. And perhaps as you collect your thoughts, I will ask the question that I know Terry wants me to ask, not that we rehearse that, but I know it's important for her. So some of the actors that remain outsiders or hidden or invisible in your work are, of course, the women that are not in the title, perhaps not in the archives, but I know that you reflected on the role of women in this kind of work. So I wonder if you would like to tell us a bit about that.
Thank you, Miria. Interesting and difficult question to answer. I think one of the reasons why I chose this t- title was that I was so tired of the kind of histories where, as if they were histories of anything, but they were actually histories of men, but it was never mentioned, and I wanted to have these men in the title, that, you know, I am writing about men here, even if I would have liked to write more about women, and there were women, but their role were research assistants. They had a significant role as spouses, but their names were never mentioned. So I thought, why don't I then say it in the title of the book and say men instead of mankind or humankind or whatever. So that was one of the reasons. I think it would be another study, and I did not do research on Lassersfeld's papers at Columbia, and it looks like that those who worked with him, they were not exclusively men. There were several women and several women who were émigré scholars. So that's another story. But since I so much concentrated on propaganda research, I think even if I tried, it was really, really difficult to find women there. For example, we talk about Mannheim. Mannheim's spouse, Julia Mannheim, was a psychoanalyst, a very, very accomplished woman, and you can see her influence on Mannheim's writings. But Mannheim's book is dedicated to her, but otherwise she doesn't get the credit, and this was the issue for most of these women. And especially, I think, poignant for those who went to the United States as émigré scholars or refugee scholars, because these programs, and I guess it was the same here, only supported male scholars, and women came as their spouses. So women lost their jobs, even if their lives were saved, but they were not there. So I think another study, and I relate that question to Wendy's very good question, why am I so interested in individuals? I have always been interested in individual histories, and in my my previous books I had this mediography method where I was using to study individuals a globalization, or how individual lives get globalized, and this is a kind of, you know, a continuation of that. And Shani Orgard, who is here, played a very important role when we were first kind of testing this mediography in our teaching. So, and she also gave very generously her the materials concerning her family to be used in the book. So I have always been interested in individuals, and I'm kind of tired when I read about paradigms or paradigm changes or theories, and there's nothing about the people, as if they would happen, you know, without individuals and groups. And this is why I'm so interested in individuals, and I really wanted to have this role of individuals examined for the book.
Thank you. Any other comments from the crowd? Yes, Marcia.
Ask the question, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
I'm assuming you can hear me. If not,
yes,
please.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry I couldn't hear Jeff, but I heard everybody else, and I wanted to thank the organizers of this session for the brilliant selection of panelists who brought up a number of questions that maybe Terry would like to talk about, and that is, how can comparative communications research deal across stated ideologies? one of the points that I was hearing made is the people who are not fitting and coming to question modernization theory or coming to question various types of capitalist theories. But is there a way that we can both do comparative media research but also do collective? I was very impressed with the teamwork, the collection, and the collectives of individuals that allow us to look past or across or compare things that are ostensibly ideologically driven. And so I wondered how we might put your idea of ideology to work, not only, or if not possible, for comparative research, to collectivities which allow the people to find some kind of commonalities or dissect what seems to be an ideology from outside, whether it's media narratives and mainstream media or our own communication research. That's my question to the panelists, for whom I thought you made wonderful points about what is neglected from the East, from the South, and from everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's keep that on the table for now, comparative as well as collective research. How can we do it? What are the challenges? Wendy, you want to add something?
Oh, well, I still had another question, which I think was partially addressed by Terry, but I'm still curious to know, like, how, what made you decide to draw your conceptual framework from the same period as, like, the scholars that you were studying, which is quite unusual, I think, for scholars. Perhaps we would be more inclined to use frameworks from a recent period, and I wondered whether there was a conscious decision that you wanted to match the time period.
Maybe if you want to respond to both comments.
No, I really would like Wendy and Bintram to respond to Marcia's really excellent question, because it is such a difficult question and you can both kind of answer it from your perspective. But I promise to come back to the issue of period, but I really want to hear your thoughts.
I'm not sure if I have a very well formulated answer to that, because when Marcia raised that question, I immediately not thought of the sort of the answer, but thought of the constraints or the challenges we face to do collective comparative research. And I think one of those challenges goes back to Wendy's point earlier about the power of funding body. What kind of research gets funded, what kind of research gets recognized or awarded as impactful research? And I think in our the previous co-authored piece, we've also critiqued some of those comparative communication research that they assemble a large team, and then they come up with all these basically media freedom index for different countries. And I think in today's funding landscape, that seems to be the kind of project that's more likely to be funded. But I'm not sure if that's the kind of comparative projects that maybe I think it still has value, but not something that both of us are more interested in pursuing. But then I think, in a way, if we try to make an effort, try to get ourselves out of this impasse, maybe we can think about collective research in a broader sense, in the sense that we are collectively generating insights when we are teaching, when we are talking to students. So if we include all our students in the conversation as part of this collective effort, I think that's something, there is always something new that comes out of that as a part of our effort, try to engage with our very diverse student body. And I think secondly, also, if I think about our department, even though we don't always write together with each other, although we have written together, and Shanae and I, we have also collaborated, and that's really a very enjoyable process. But I think, again, also thinking about the conversation taking place in the corridor, conversation taking place in our research away day, And if we think about the department as a, also as a collective, even though sometimes we work and write individually, but I think collectively there's something to be said about, for example, us having more than one double degree programs of so many of us doing comparative research. So that's not my, you know, it's not a good answer. It's not a perfect solution, but it's an effort trying to address.
It's a great answer. Wendy, looking to that?
Yeah, I would probably echo what Bing Chung has already mentioned. And I think particularly in journalism studies, which is a field I'm not necessarily so familiar with, but I know that there are a lot of empirical, large-scale projects that do comparative research. And yeah, I also would be concerned about the power relations behind those projects. I've been on the receiving end of a project like that as well when I was based in a South African university, and where the terms, yeah, were largely stipulated by the donor. And it didn't allow for much kind of theoretical development because the terms were already set. And I think several colleagues in the department have written about this. I think both my colleague Sonia Livingston and Nick Cold, we have written about, is it Nick, I think, who posed the question, what do we compare if we do comparative research? And I think that is a crucial question. Because the unit of comparison could often also be seen as ideologically driven, right? Or it could, as Bing Chung mentioned about the Media Freedom Index. So I think this is really difficult, and perhaps the best comparative projects are those which are not hierarchically structured, where there is a lot of time and space to think more inductively through grounded theory what we need to compare. But in the current landscape, there's probably not a lot of time for these kind and money for these kind of projects.
Well, we'll open the floor to questions in a minute after we hear from Terry.
I don't know whether I have anything to add to my colleagues. Answers, because it's such a difficult question. It's so easy to criticize the existing research, but then to come up with new ideas. And there must be a reason why, for example, content analysis and quantitative content analysis, that was developed to analyze war propaganda during the Second World War, is still so popular. Many of our students want to do quantitative content analysis, and it all goes back to this period when war propaganda was analyzed. And we haven't come kind of methodologically, I think, both theoretically and methodologically, I think, you know, comparative communication research needs to take, you know, huge steps. Again, I think, you know, the how, and you both referred to this, how comparative communication research was collective. And again, this war propaganda research set the precedent. And then now if we think of edited books or research project, it is the kind of recipe that we have researchers from different countries with their language skills and their local knowledge, and then we put them together. And I think Sonia Livingstone wrote a long time ago that it's not enough if you have an edited book with authors from, let's say, 10 different countries and an introduction. That does not make it a comparative research project. But it's so easy, in a way, to say all these things, and I think we all agree. And numerous people before us have complained how international communication is kind of theoretically underdeveloped and methodologically as well. And with social media and with this kind of huge numbers of different outlets and their messages. So how do we do comparative communication research in this new situation? I think, you know, we just have to think really hard and start thinking about it because we don't have any ready and made answers here. And hopefully the students who are here are the generation that will be able to provide new answers. Marcia, sorry about this really, really bad answer, but we are thinking aloud more than anything else, I think.
Shall we open the floor then and hear what students and colleagues have to say? Can we take, can I see if there are any questions? We have a question there and there. We have two questions. We will take them together. Maybe we'll take those three questions together and come back to the panel. If you would like to introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. My name is Burce Burcecelik from Loughborough University. I teach there. it sounds fascinating, the book. I think I'm coming from more like the position where Wendy is coming from, like the reparatory history and decolonization of knowledge through history. So I think, I think that's sort of like the concept of utopia and ideology tells a lot about your approach. And I, you know, as one of the panelists said, like utopia must be the sort of like the liberal utopia, I guess, and ideology is always the non-liberal medias. So, and systems. So my question is that, like, in relation to this, you know, future of comparative research, you know, the comparative research has often taken this, like, very colonial sort of perspective through the names that were mentioned, Lerner and Laswell and Lazarsfeld and the others. They all compared to sort of like the ideality, no? Like the ideal media system and et cetera. So one of the key problems, I guess, with the comparative research is that, like, you take the West, Anglo-European, you know, model as a sort of like yardstick for the others. But how about taking the European, Anglo-European context as a yardstick for how bad the system is? And, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about, comparative colonialism studies, for instance, American colonialism, media colonialism, UK colonialism. I'm thinking about Ottoman colonialism. You know, this could be a way to go forward, perhaps. And, what would you think about?
Thank you. Could you pass the microphone? Yes.
Thank you. I'm Kevin Smets from VUB and currently a visiting fellow here. Thank you for a really inspiring panel. And I also wanted to push a bit further on one of the final points on what is the unit of analysis in comparative communication studies. And I had to think all the way through the panel about methodological nationalism, whereby, I mean, I guess it's a critique on the idea of the nation state or the state as a sort of natural unit of analyzing, understanding the social reality. And I wanted to ask if this is at all meaningful as a way to think about the future of comparative communication research, and what are some of the alternative units of analysis if we look within and especially probably across different states.
Thank you. If you could pass the microphone there. Sonia.
Hi, I'm Sonia Livingstone. I'm from the Department of Media and Communications here. And thank you so much for a really thought-provoking panel. And congratulations to Terry for the book. So I think there was some difference between what Terry said and what Jeff said. And I just wanted to dwell on that. So Terry said our present media and communications is marked by its history and its founding fathers, and actually I'd love to know more. But Jeff said we've forgotten the past, and that seems like we're the worst of both worlds. We're marked by the past and we can't remember why. And I'm wondering what we shall do. So shall we remember our history better to shake it off and shake off its influence? And can we lose our past and then merge in this new flow of many disciplines becoming students of digital society? I'm less optimistic than Jeff about that, and I don't know what Terry thinks, so I'm curious.
Let me just check if there is any last question that we will take before coming back to the panel. Okay, so back to the panel. I think we'll start with you, Terry.
Let's start with Jeff.
Okay, let's start with Jeff, putting you on the spot.
because Sonia asked a question.
Yes.
Okay, I hope you can still hear me.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
If so, I'm assuming you can hear me. Excellent. Sonia, thanks for that. I should explain a little bit about my claim about the declining significance of memory for communication research. Just because I had looked at this amazing issue that Marcia co-edited from 1983, which was rich with historical claims about the field, all kinds of tropes, some of them were completely absurd in historical terms, but nevertheless, there was a kind of shared disciplinary stock of memory that could be referred to, availability. And when I looked at Henley Kinder issue in 1993, there were still plenty of memory claims, you could call them, about the history of the field. And in both cases, U.S. focused, but with some international claims as well. And what was striking is that by 2008, and most notably in 2018, there was almost nothing by way of disciplinary memory that could be called upon. There's a profound drop-off, in other words. And this was the source for my sort of cheeky point about both insiders and outsiders being forgotten. And that includes everyone in a way. There's a sort of, in my view, amnesiac field. And I do think it's too bad. I do think that Wendy's repertory on both sides that she talks about, kind of recovering voices that were never really in the historiography in the first place, and then decentering, those whose prominence might have been undeserved or at least partially positioned in such a way as to legitimize the field or provide an origin myth. I think both of those projects are of vital importance. I just think the practical sociology of the study of digital life means that there's no shared reference period, and that this is, in historical terms, a definite loss. There may be, however, as I said, some gains in terms of the status problem that the organized discipline of media has had.
Would you like to follow?
Thank you, Sonia, for an excellent question. I think it would be kind of public suicide if I would say that history does not matter and we would forget all of it because it's not useful anymore. What I was trying to do in the book is to shed light on those who have been forgotten and think that by understanding their life and their struggles and all that, we actually understand us and our research better. And it's, as I try to say in my talk, I think it's very difficult to do that kind of research on contemporary academia. I think perhaps all of us have been indirectly saying, and I'm sorry if I put words into your mouth, that in this present situation, it's very difficult to talk about some issues. And I think I was, I had a talk with Bing Chung at some point, and I said, I only think that doing historical research, I can address questions I can't address in this present atmosphere. Often because media and communication studies as a field is so present and future oriented. And we are not even ourselves aware of our ideologies and utopias. We are very happy to criticize other people's ideologies and utopias, but at the same time, this self-reflection, I think, is needed. And when one does historical research and talk about these issues and tries to show with empirical examples how these concepts worked, hopefully it makes us to think about ourselves because we are not above it. You know, I think somebody said that journalists are the only profession where they still think that they have the truth. and maybe academia is one of the institutions where we still think that we have the truth. But I think we should also reflect on ourselves. That's the best answer I can give. And I wouldn't give up history. I would be the last person to give up history. I'm a self-confessed archival rat and enjoy my time in archives, and I would never ever give it up.
Would you like to address the other two questions on methodological nationalism and the comparison of
colonialism? I was thinking that Bing Chung and Wendy could both do it. I can join them, but Wendy would certainly could talk about colonialism. And Bing Chung and I, we have been talking endlessly about the unit of comparative communication research, so I know both of you would have excellent answers.
Okay. Taking that we have about 3 minutes left, maybe you can share that between you.
Yeah, I mean, on the unit of analysis, I think we teach in our week, which we all have taught at some point on comparative research, we talk about other units of analysis like the city, etc. And Maria can speak to this very much as well, I think. On colonialism, yeah, absolutely. Comparative work is also very helpful there, and to see how different templates for colonial ideas were shared across the empire. If we think about how different media were imagined by colonial administrators, and how certain media were considered to be suitable for colonized populations than others weren't, and we can think about how different, perhaps also look at comparative media studies in a historical period, right? Or to do it retrospectively, perhaps, and to examine that. So I think there's a lot more work. I think we haven't quite understood the impact of colonialism on media systems or media cultures across the world. There's still a lot more of work to be done, more historical work to be done. We've talked about this in some way during the as part of the media imperialism paradigm, but in a way there also we displace history because we talk more about a newer empire, about a US empire, at the expense of an older empire. And in the context that I study, Southern Africa, memories of empire are so alive. So I think this is why I'm very much drawn to these arguments.
Yes, so on the unit of comparison, I think we have had a lot of discussions both between us and also with our students. And I think in a way, this probably also links to Sonia's question about whether history is actually remembered or forgotten. Because if we really look at the genealogy of the term comparative research or comparative media research, this notion itself already implies taking nation state as the analytical, as a default analytical unit, because it was so much associated with the Cold War, the history of the Cold War, and all that. So I think in that sense, maybe when we say whether, when we think about whether history is forgotten or remembered, I think sometimes in our research, these founding fathers, that they have already defined the paradigm and the concept. We have also so internalized the concepts and the perspectives that they proposed. And we forgot then to unpack that. We forgot also to link the concepts with the historical period and also with their own biography. And I think maybe in a way by revisiting the biography and the connection between the research agenda and the biography, that's a way for us to develop a new critique of the history.
And if I may say, what, 60 seconds? So I think one of the issues I tried to raise was, and I have been using the term comparative communications or comparative media and communication studies instead of international communication. And one of the reasons is exactly what Wendy and Bing Chung were talking about, that when we think of the units of analysis, and Miria's work is all about it, we automatically, if we use international communication, it is comparing nation states. And since we wanted individually and collectively to start alternative ways to do comparative research, I think introducing a new term would be helpful.
Thank you. I think that's a very nice invite, intellectual invite to finish with. Brings us back also with to one of the questions that our panelist online has raised. How do we think comparatively and collectively? So I want to first say that we can continue the conversation over a glass of wine or oranges. We have a reception outside to celebrate Terry's book. There are books outside as well that you can buy, and Terry will be around if you would like her to sign it. So please join me before we close to thank all our panelists. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.